Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
Geothermal energy, heat and water from deep within the earth, is gaining interest for future energy generation. It can come from more than just volcanoes and hot springs, such as heat pumps that use Earth's warmth to help lower home and business heating costs. But volcanoes offer a much larger potential for generating a lot of steam power. Advocates say it could also be used for aiding food production in remote locations, creating cleaner fuel, and possibly power remote data centers. What are the risks associated with developing energy from these sources, and how close is the technology for making it happen? The prospect for developing geothermal energy in Alaska is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. It sounds too good to be true. A source of steady, long-term, renewable energy with a minimal footprint, no mining, no waste. So why aren't there power plants and indoor vegetable production facilities near any of Alaska's volcanoes now? What does it take to tap into this immense heat and steam source from deep within the earth? And how close are we to following Iceland's lead on taking advantage of this non-polluting source of energy? Our guests today are in Anchorage this week for a conference on sustainable energy to discuss a wide range of energy options for Alaska. The conference will feature information on sources we're all familiar with, oil and gas, and also hydro, wind, solar, and geothermal. And today on Talk of Alaska, we're talking heat. Ground heat that creates steam power and a lot of it. With us today is Gwen Holdman. Gwen is the director of the University of Fairbanks Center for Energy and Power and is joining us from the conference, so she's not in the studio with us, but we're glad to have her on the line. John Eichelberger is the geothermal program manager for the state's Department of Natural Resources and is in the studio with us today. And Anthony Panino is on the board of directors for Geo Alaska, a company working to develop geothermal energy from sources such as Mount Augustine volcano. We'll hear more about that soon. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. So Gwen and John, set the stage for us here. Clarify how geothermal energy works and the ways it's being used currently. John, well, you start us
off? Okay, sure. Well, it's hot inside the earth. You probably know that. I think it's like 6,000 Celsius at the very center.
Yep, that's hot.
The heat, interestingly enough, is from radioactive decay, things we inherited from the solar nebula. That's not to say we're exposing ourselves to radiation. That's fine. It's just that rocks do not conduct heat very well, so and the Earth produces more heat then it can just conduct away, so it sweats. Volcanoes are Earth sweat, just like
that. Is a really interesting way to think about it. Sweating so, volcanoes.
Yes, it's Earth sweat, and it carries with it a tremendous amount of energy, not just the high temperature, but you know, if you live in Fairbanks, many of you don't, if you put a bucket of water outside at minus 40, it's not going to freeze overnight. That's because an enormous amount of energy is released in the crystallization process. It's the same as magma. So this is an incredible energy source, whether you tap it at a distance or whether you get close to it or even in it. This is a remarkable, unused, almost, except for the exemplary Chena Hot Springs Resort. If we were a separate country, what would you say about us? You would say that we're one of the most richest countries in geothermal energy in the world and the least to use it. So this is a fantastic opportunity for us.
Gwen, do you want to follow up there and add some comments about geothermal, what it is?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing when we use the word geothermal, we kind of use it as this catch-all, but there's really a lot of different kinds of geothermal energy. Like John is saying, it's, you know, fundamentally, it's emanating, you know, heat from the center of the earth or from the mantle. But there's a lot of different ways that that heat gets to the surface through different sort of pathways that allow us to sort of exploit that heat where it's a little bit more concentrated closer to the surface. And Alaska is a really good example of a place that has these different sorts of traditional geothermal settings. Southeast Alaska has a lot of deep fracturing and faults where you get really deep circulation of water. And water is really sort of that medium that we often use to actually extract heat, you know, from the core, from the crust. So we're kind of using that almost like a heat exchanger with the earth, where we're circulating that water and getting heat. So the hot springs in Southeast Alaska are sort of based on that kind of a setting, you know. In the Aleutians, we obviously have these like volcanic arc, and so, you know, magma that enables like the potential development of super hot geothermal resources. And then in interior Alaska, John just alluded to the Chena Hot Springs geothermal project. That's actually near surface radioactive decay in like plutons of a certain age that have high levels of uranium and thorium. That heat, as John said, rocks don't conduct heat very well, so it's sort of trapped in that sort of near surface. And so those kinds of granitic rocks, they kind of crack and fracture really well in lots of different directions. So that's another way that we can find circulation pathways of water from the surface into these hotter rocks that are sort of near surface. And so that's another pathway or another type of geothermal we have here in Alaska. And then I also don't want to minimize the potential for like geothermal heat pumps, which a lot of people, when they think about geothermal, there's sort of that conventional geothermal, higher temperature. But there's also a lot of use of various heat pump technologies in Alaska that's not really using any kind of elevated gradient, but we're still able to take some of that heat from the earth for like space heating and things like that. So it's kind of a pretty broad range of technologies and ways that we're extracting heat from the earth.
Thank you, John and Gwen, for starting us off here on this discussion about geothermal's potential in Alaska. Anthony, turning to you, GeoAlaska is about 5 years old. How did you and your partner get into the geothermal business and why?
Well, thanks for your opportunity for having us speak here today. So I lived in Anchorage my whole life, you know, traditionally worked oil and gas projects for about 25 years, and about 5 years ago made more of a pivot over to green energy renewable projects. Long story short, Dr. Paul Craig, who's the majority owner and CEO of GeoAlaska, and I have known each other for years. I actually bought his house in Turnagain, so we've known each other both professionally and personally over the years. And Paul similarly was more in the oil and gas field in terms of like buying leases, speculating, things of that nature in terms of developing leases. And he pivoted to geothermal just because he saw some opportunity there, brought me on board because I had expertise from an oil and gas perspective of actually how to develop projects and how to schedule things out and look at all the technical capabilities. And obviously, we focused on Augustine Island, like you previously mentioned, for a variety of different reasons. It's in a great location. From a geologic perspective, it's very well understood. It's probably the most studied volcano in the United States. John Eichelberger has studied Augustine Island, and many of the folks over at the Alaska Volcano Observatory have studied it. So a lot was known about Augustine, so it just made it a very attractive place for us to look at a potential project.
And you got the leases for Augustine in 2021 and Mount Spur in 2025. Really interesting. We'll talk about that in a bit. And as you mentioned, you previously worked in the oil and gas industry and said in an earlier interview that scoping projects in that setting and in geothermal are similar. Describe what you meant by that.
Yeah, just a correction. So our leases at Augustine were in 2021 and Spur in 2021.
Oh, sorry.
We got additional lease acreage at Augustine in 2025, actually, through the state
Augustine,
of Alaska.
Sorry.
So that's okay.
Oops.
Just wanted to correct you there.
I'm glad
so,
you did.
Yeah, developing and building large green energy projects are very analogous to oil and gas projects. I mean, it's a long process. I always use the analogy, it's like eating an 800-pound elephant. You just do it one bite at a time. It's not something you try to wrap your arms all around at the beginning. So analogous to oil and gas, you know, we knew that we had a reservoir. So we spent some time and effort in actually doing measurements of the subsurface, which had actually never been done at Augustine. So it was great. And that's an analogy to, say, seismic work you do at Prudhoe Bay, for example, when an oil company wants to go and actually look at their reservoir and what the asset is. We were actually able to share that data with AVO, DOE, USGS, and they knew that what they thought the volcano looked like, but to actually see it like in real life was like pretty awesome to share it. It was like they looked like kids on Christmas Day opening presents. So it was pretty pretty interesting. So, and then the next step after you obviously identify the resources, you drill a test well, analogous to what you do on oil and gas. So it's a lot of the steps are similar. It's just a different type of technology and a different type of customer and things like that that you're dealing with.
And staying with you for one more question, Anthony, were you motivated to move to a more renewable type of energy industry because of concerns over climate change? Or is there new technology that is making geothermal energy production more feasible and affordable? What was the rationale for you?
I would say from my personal and professional perspective, I wanted to stay in Alaska. And the oil and gas business, as you know, is quite cyclical. And I kind of saw some writing on the wall in terms of like stability for myself and my family of raising them in Anchorage, where, you know, my whole family lives as well. I was involved pretty early days in terms of like green energy projects. And obviously, a lot of people that I work with are former oil and gas people because it's a similar skill set from a professional perspective. So,
all right. John, back to you now. And before we do that, let me remind folks that you're listening to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about the potential for developing geothermal energy here in our state. In the studio with me today is John Eichelberger. John is a volcanologist and the geothermal program manager for the Department of Natural Resources. Gwen Holdman is on the line from the Sustainable Energy Conference in downtown Anchorage. She is the director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Energy and Power. And also in the studio is Anthony Panino. Anthony is on the board of directors for GeoAlaska. John, how long has the state offered geothermal leases and how has interest changed?
Boy, the lease thing is, I guess they've been available for a long time. It's been streamlined, I believe, under our present governor. But just to veer around that, because I don't know about the business end of things. I know about the science end of things, and 50 years ago, at the beginning of my career, I witnessed the first pushes by the government for geothermal, wind, solar, and magma. And then the push for what we then called alternative energy went away because we discovered we had plenty of fossil fuels, hydrocarbons. Now, 50 years later, we have too much. We're discovering CO2. But 50 years ago, I got infected with drilling molten rock. You can drill a liquid. How do you do it? Well, you put water down and it turns to glass. And it was just fascinating. I did this in Hawaii, but then we couldn't find magma. So for decades, I thought, oh, I'm never going to live to see this. But all of a sudden, people started hitting magma by accident. And with it goes super hot you get a tremendous range of increase in efficiency of power plants, in the amount of energy the fluid carries, and in sustainability of the system. And it's the smallest footprint of any kind of power supply. There's no mines, there's no waste isolation issue. And there's, for the most part, there's more CO2. So we have all these kinds of drivers here. We've got a CO2 crisis that we've got to do something about. We have a rail belt crisis where we're 85% dependent on natural gas for electricity, which is not a good place to be. And then we have all these rural villages where the technology now permits us to get, only a few megawatts, but that makes a huge difference for a small community sure. that would otherwise have to ship in diesel at enormous expense and pollution costs. So everything is converging right now.
And John, staying with you, you noted in an earlier interview that we're a country rich in geothermal with almost zero use of it. And it's not a new area of research, as you've just been noting. Why do you think we're not farther along?
Well, that's a good question. For one thing, it takes brave people like Anthony and Paul Craig of GeoAlaska to go after these things. You know, if you build a dam, you know exactly how much electricity you're going to generate from it. If you start to develop a geothermal power plant, you don't know ahead of time. There is a lot of geophysics and stuff you can do, but you just have to drill and find out, and that is very expensive. So there's an investment challenge. I think there's some other things. Our lower 48 country persons are basically afraid of the logistics up here. Prefer pickup trucks to helicopters, and I don't know why. And then in Europe, there are a lot of European countries that are trying to help small villages in Latin America, where native, ancient cultures and languages are threatened. They have no idea that we have the same issue here on a giant scale. So helping these villages be sustainable, that's what's driving me. I have a passion for this stuff, and I finally got a job to do it, thanks to the state.
That's great. Gwen, apparently I've made a second mistake already today on the show. Your title is Chief Scientist and Program Lead, not Director, at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Sorry about that. You are the engineer that brought the Chena Hot Springs geothermal power plant online. It's currently the only one in the state. Walk us through how that was developed, the time it took, the cost, and if you know, how does John was just talking about, the expense, the enormous expense in drilling, especially exploratory wells, to figure out what the potential is. And I wonder how that compares to when people are drilling those exploratory wells for fossil fuel.
Yeah, the Chena Hot Springs project, it's a really kind of a unique set of circumstances that allowed us to develop that project. I think it's still the lowest temperature geothermal power plant anywhere in the world right now. It's not very high temperature. It's about the temperature of a good hot cup of coffee, maybe. So about 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And at the time that we developed that, it was believed that you couldn't develop that as a commercially viable geothermal resource. But we were able to work with some vendors in the refrigeration industry to basically reverse engineer refrigeration system. So with refrigeration, you put in electric power and you get an area of cold inside your refrigerator, and you're basically rejecting heat out the back of it through the coils. And in this case, we were basically taking an area of hot, which was the geothermal resource, and cold air and cold water that we have available in abundance in interior Alaska, especially in the winter months, and then using that to drive the cycle backwards and generate electric power. And so it was a pretty different approach because we were using largely off-the-shelf refrigeration equipment, which really brought down the cost. But from the resource perspective, because we had near surface, we knew there's hot springs there. So we knew there was hot water. So it's really a matter of like understanding the geology and how water and fluids are moving below ground. But the actual development of that resource, because it is low temperature, it's not going to flash into a steam. We know that there's limitations in terms of like how hot that water has got below ground. It was a lot easier to develop, and drilling these wells was very different. Those kinds of systems, like the one at Chena, it's not very efficient. Like the thermal efficiency for, you know, generating electric power is like 6%. But because the fuel is free, that efficiency means a little bit less, and it's in a remote area. It's not grid connected to Fairbanks. And so what you're comparing that to is diesel generation, which, as we know from many of our rural communities that rely heavily on diesel, is a very expensive way to generate power. And so that project made sense there. But really the magic sauce, the reason we could get away with a lower temperature geothermal resource, is because of those really good cold resources that helped us on the other end of the cycle. It's really the difference between how hot your geothermal resource is and how cold or cool your ambient temperatures are. And so that delta T, that difference in temperature, really tells you how much power you can generate and how efficiently you can generate that. So we're in a pretty unique situation there, but it's been a pretty remarkable project. I was pretty fortunate to get to be involved with it.
How much power does it generate?
Well, the original power plant that I was involved with was about 400 kilowatts. So that's a really small project. So this is a complete order of magnitude different than what, you know, Anthony and Paul are looking at developing with Augustine. So this is maybe the amount of power that would power a medium-sized village, which Chena Hot Springs in a way is, between the guests that are staying there and the employees that live out there. It's kind of like a small village. And so 400 kilowatts is really not that much power. They've added another generator since then, and they've made some changes. I think the total install capacity right now is around 700 kilowatts, but they're just generating like a couple hundred kilowatts. And then they're using that water. And this is one thing that's really brilliant about geothermal, is you have this potential for different kinds of uses. It's not just about power generation, as with a lot of other renewables, but it's also about other ways you can use that heat even after it comes out of the back end of that process. So the Ice Museum at Chena Hot Springs was historically cooled using hot water, which sounds very counterintuitive. And then they have year-round greenhouses out there, which are the only ones in the interior, because of that geothermal heat that they're able to keep those greenhouses warm. So there's a lot of cascading uses of geothermal on that site. And that's true in many places, other places as well.
And if you're not using diesel, you're not also pumping more pollution into the air. So that's a big benefit as well. This and also the expense of diesel and shipping it around the state. Gwen, tell us about the Pilgrim Hot Springs project near Nome. How does its formation compare with Chena, and where is that project in development?
Yeah, so Pilgrim Hot Springs is a little ways north of Nome. Just like most of our really good geothermal resources in this site, it's just not co-located with a population center, which is one of the big challenges with developing the resource. We often have to build expensive transmission or find other ways to move that energy or use it beneficially. So Pilgrim Hot Springs is a small hot springs. It's much higher temperature than Chena in this kind of more broader sort of low temperature geothermal area. So it's pretty close to boiling, or right around boiling temperature, just right below the surface there, which is really cool. And the Seward Peninsula overall is kind of an area where there's like more of a spreading crust. It's kind of an unusual geologic setting in Alaska. And it's a little bit more like Iceland in some ways. And so there's a lot more heat coming from from like kind of the mantle probably there in that area. And so we have been working with the site owners, the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power on doing resource evaluation and exploration, which is really the expensive and risky part of geothermal development. And they're now at the point where they have a small production well that's been drilled out there. And the owners, Unatuk, it's a private organization that's a consortium of seven different local, tribal, and regional organizations in the region. They're hoping to have a power plant operating to serve that site just locally next summer. And they're kind of waiting on a NEPA determination. So sort of like a federal NEPA process is what they're going through right now. But if that's successful, they have a vendor lined up. They would put in an order for this very small, much smaller than China even, power plant just to power the site there and the operations that they have going on at that location. Now that could actually lead to much larger development in the future. But right now, one of the best ways for us to know what that resource is able to sustainably produce is to start producing it at a small level and seeing how the reservoir reacts, what it does. And then that will help determine, you know, what level of power could be generated from that resource later. Our work at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power indicated it could power as much as 5 megawatts, which is really a very significant amount for that region. That's about what Nome consumes. And then of course there's a potential for the Graphite One mine, which is even closer to that particular site.
And you mentioned NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. Do you foresee any problems through that process for this project?
I really hope not. I would like to see this project go forward. I mean, there are some, you know, it's in an area where there's wetlands. It's an area that's on the National Historic Registry. So there's a lot of like, you know, things that you need to be careful about to make sure that you're minimizing impact on the local environment. But I think that the local stakeholders have it pretty well sorted out. And so I'm really hoping that that process can be expedited and they can move forward with the next step of their project as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you for that. We are coming up on a break and we are going to take it right now. We'll be back in just a moment with more discussion about the potential for developing geothermal energy in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the potential for developing geothermal energy here in our state. In the studio with me today is John Eichelberger. John is the geothermal program manager for the Department of Natural Resources for the state. And also in the studio is Anthony Panino. Anthony is on the board of directors for GeoAlaska that is seeking to develop geothermal projects here in Alaska. And Gwen Holdman is on the line from the Sustainable Energy Conference in downtown Anchorage. She is the chief scientist and program lead for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Center for Energy and Power. John, turning back to you, you had said earlier that where we are on the Ring of Fire is like the Prudhoe Bay of geothermal. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have, by our definition, 50 active volcanoes. Now, how do you define it? Usually it's recorded history. Well, ours is very short. It's when the Russians came. I mean, there's oral history. It goes way back before that. In Italy or Japan, recorded history goes 3,000 years back. But if you look at the Pacific Ring of Fire, we have the only neglected segment, and we also have more densely packed volcanoes than any other place around that. You asked earlier, why are we moving so slowly? Well, for one thing, it's fairly new. An Italian invented it in 1906, I believe it was, in Lauderella. We were pumping gas in oil and gas in Pennsylvania a long time before that. So there's been more learning, there's been more government investment, and which has been very important in research and development. The other thing is remoteness. We've had, for a long time, we felt that the power had to be generated near the consumer. Well, again, the Prudhoe Bay analogy is good because the consumer is
a long way away.
Yeah.
Yes.
California and, so, and Hawaii. You can overcome these problems, particularly not because now because there are big advances in transmission, high voltage direct current, and in submarine cables, all these wind farms. And you can also manufacture energy-intensive things on site. Icelanders have been doing this for a long, long time, shipping in, Alcoa ships in aluminum ore from South America, and then electricity is cheap in Iceland, so they process it there. We can do the same thing, only there are all kinds of new technologies with green fuels and even green foods, making proteins out of thin air. All these things are energy intensive. And then you top that off with the fact that the world is changing fast. We're going to have a lot of electric transportation and a lot of ships going right through the Aleutian Islands across the Arctic Ocean. And we are poisoning ourselves. So
we need to move.
We need to move.
And John, sticking with you for just a moment more, you're a volcanologist, which is like the coolest job title ever. You're now monitoring volcanoes less for eruption concerns and more for energy generation ideas, as you've been talking about. Why is Augustine more feasible than Mount Spur for energy generation? Mount Spur is a lot closer to Anchorage. So why is Augustine a better bet?
Yes, and it was explored. Spur was explored quite a bit. I think the answer is you've got to have the heat source, which is magma, whether you're close to it or not. You got to have it at shell depth, and the spur magma comes up basically from the base of the crust and shoots up a similar distance into the air, and the heat is all gone. Whereas with Augustine, there's an accumulation of magma that's a conservative estimate, a few cubic kilometers. That's a lot of magma, and that is, you could run several gigawatts thermal for 200 years off of that. So Augustine is a much better prospect.
All right, and we're going to have Anthony fill us in on some of the work that they're going to be doing at Augustine. But first, let's go to the phones for a moment. Elthi, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is in Utqiagvik, Barrow. Elthi, your question.
Good morning, Kuyana. My question has to do with methanol, and mainly because the ice cellars that we use up here to store our hunting, what we get. For example, in my region, the bowhead whale that we hunt, and primarily we store the meat for use in June, as well as in Thanksgiving and Christmas. And as far as my ice cellar is concerned, we cannot use it because of methanol. And so my question is, how does this methanol affect the whole area of geothermal energy surge, especially in the Arctic? Thank you.
Thanks, Elthi. I'm not sure that methanol is involved. It's a thawing of the permafrost that is causing ice cellar failures. Sadly, that that ancient technology that was so effective and efficient for people for thousands of years is becoming less reliable now, and it's because of John. It's climate change, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And
yeah,
Gwen?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I'm afraid there's not much geothermal can do to help you there,
in
except for long distance transmission of electrical energy. And it's cold there. Nice place for a power plant because, as Gwen mentioned, it's a temperature drop that really counts.
Mm-hmm.
I'll chime in here,
yeah,
if
please,
you don't mind,
Gwen.
Lori.
Please do.
There are complementary technologies that help us, make better use of energy from the environment, whether it's geothermal heat from the earth or from the air. And one thing that has been done related to kind of protecting ice cellars from, permafrost degradation is installing passive thermosiphons, where you can actually extract heat from the ground. It's kind of like those, when you see those fins on the Trans-Alaska pipeline, that's sort of extracting heat from the ground to keep the ground stable. You can install those kinds of thermosiphons. We use them on all kinds of foundations in the Arctic, in places where there is, the potential for melting permafrost. And those have been successfully used in conjunction with traditional ice cellars to kind of keep them better frozen. And it's a very passive way of extracting heat from the earth and keeping it frozen and stable. So that's something to consider.
Absolutely. I've heard of that technology being used in some areas, as you've mentioned, Gwen, to kind of just bleed off that heat, siphon it away from the ice cellar. Maybe it could be captured to use it in a household setting. I don't know, but that could be something to look into. Good luck with it, Elthie. I know that that's a sad situation to see those ice cellars that were so reliable for so long. And if people have to buy a regular type of freezer, of course, that creates other expense because you have to have electricity, and that can be very expensive in rural places. So, Anthony, you're working on the leases on Augustine. You've done two seasons of subsurface work. Describe what MT studies are and what you're looking for in this subsurface preliminary work.
Sure. So MT survey, magnetic telluric surveys, basically goes, we got resolution down to about 7 kilometers, 7,000 meters, which is pretty significant. Obviously, it's about 4.5 miles down the subsurface. So we were obviously able to tell from that survey different temperature gradients and different functions in terms of more of the traditional geothermal system, which is your 250 to 270 degrees Celsius, which is, north of 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Just getting back to some of the numbers like Gwen was talking about at Chena Hot Springs and at Pilgrim, we're obviously significantly much higher than that. So what our surveys did was we were able to take that data and basically have a third-party engineering company build us a model and say, hey, based on your traditional geothermal system, we think you can produce a little north of 200 megawatts of exportable power. And just to give you a reference, the entire grid from, Homer up to Fairbanks on average uses about 500 megawatts. So you're looking at about 40% of the total grid. Mm. Obviously, as previously mentioned, we recently doubled our lease acreage on Augustine. So we think we have significantly more power than that. And so everyone asks, well, what are you going to do with the power? And this gets back to the conversations earlier is, in the past, really the only opportunity you had from an economic perspective was to sell the electricity to utilities or to put it into the grid. In the last 10 years, the explosion of data centers, for example, they need 100 gigawatts of power a year for the next 10 years. And that's where it's a function of, yes, we can build a line and put electrons in a line so people can turn their lights on and off, but we can also export ones and zeros. You can put a data center on Augustine. And the great thing about Augustine, getting back to this conversation about NEPA, is Augustine's 100% on state lands. So there's no federal lands there. There's no Native Corporation lands. There's really no flora or fauna there. It's because it's had a lot of volcanic activity, obviously over the last thousands of years. There's no wetlands. There's no anadromous salmon streams. There's some ephemeral bodies of water, but nothing in terms of a NEPA perspective that would preclude you from doing development in a reasonable time frame. And then also it's kind of in that southern part of Cook Inlet that's kind of like the banana belt of Cook Inlet, where we want to drill, we can drill year-round. Whereas if you're drilling at Spur, for example, you're up at a much higher elevation, a lot more snowfall. And when you said before, well, Spur is closer to Anchorage, but Spur also has bears, moose, eagles, you know, anadromous salmon streams, things of that nature that would make it more difficult strictly from a NEPA perspective to develop that project. So there's a lot of nuance and a lot of, you know, like you said before, a lot of analogies with oil and gas projects. You could have a great oil and gas prospect, but it might be in an area where you're never going to get a permit because you're right near the whale hunting, for example, in Nuiqsut or things of that nature. So, we're very bullish on Augustine for obviously from the scientific perspective, like we've been talking about, but also just the executability of a project there and proximity to markets.
Mm-hmm. And have you been hoping for, you know, I know that a business such as yours takes a lot of investment. Were you hoping to get any sort of federal assistance in that regard? Because as we've seen recently, under the Trump administration, there's been a great chilling effect when it comes to investing in anything renewable.
Yeah, at this point, we really haven't gone down that road yet, quite frankly. A lot of it just has to do with timing. The process to get certain federal funds can be very lengthy. And when you're a privately owned company that, we're obviously investing our own money into this company, sometimes time is more important than money from an execution perspective. So there's obviously some portions of the IRA, for example, that would be advantageous to us. That's not necessarily like federal grants or funding. Investment tax credits, for example, is one key one that's part of the IRA that I think is going to survive all the cuts from the IRA. But no, we haven't been predicated on federal funds just because there's timing issues, there's confidentiality issues. You know, if, say, for example, all this data we collected, if we would have got it through a federal grant, there could be some issues where we'd have to share that data with the public. And we want to keep it, you know, it's commercially sensitive data. It's very valuable data. So, for example, during this previous lease sale here a couple months ago, we kind of knew what was there and we had that data. So it gave us some commercial advantages in terms of pursuing those additional lease acreages.
All right. Thank you for that. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the potential for geothermal energy production in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the geothermal potential in our state. And we're going to turn to some email questions now. Let's see here. Here is a question from Frankie in Juneau. Please talk about the scale, size, budget for projects that might be useful by location in rural small communities that could use geothermal specifically without building huge interconnected energy systems. And that's kind of one of the big bright points in geothermal, is it not, that it can be quite localized and doesn't have to be something that's connected for great distances, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of hot springs in the state, and many of them are close to or actually co-located with rural, mostly native villages. So, there's a big opportunity there.
We also, go ahead.
I might add, you might ask, why all this now? Well, it's not just about carbon dioxide. It's, again, we have an energy crisis. A year ago, the government was saying consumption of electricity would be flat. Now they're projecting 30% or more by the end of this decade. Why is it? It's artificial intelligence. Data centers gobble huge amounts of electricity.
Bitcoin mining.
Yeah. And then here, mining eats up huge amounts of electricity. The biggest consumer in the rail belt is Fort Knox. And there are much bigger mines planned. So that's going to drive things as well. There's just a feeding frenzy in geothermal right now.
We also had another question from Art in Chitna asking, what are the prospects for converting decommissioned oil wells to geothermal, given their depth, ubiquity, and frequent location adjacent to other infrastructure? Is that at all a possibility?
That's definitely being looked at a lot. First of all, you have to have a warmer than normal oil well. There are places in Northern Cook Inlet where that's the case. It's not clear it would be, it could be done. It's not clear it could be done economically. I guess that's a, but it's definitely a possibility.
Interesting.
I think just to add a point there, one critical piece of information there is obviously the well logs from those wells that were drilled would give you really good geologic information. And obviously they log the temperature of the water that's encountered. So they know, for example, and I think this person emailed from Chitna is in the Otna region. I know they had drilled some oil and gas wells many, many years ago where they encountered warm water. So that's actually some pretty positive information. They may not necessarily be able to reuse those wells because a lot of them have been P&A'd. A plug and abandoned. So you can't just go back and potentially use the well. But the data that was collected from that well could help guide any potential geothermal prospects in that area.
We have an email question here. And to be clear, this person is asking about drilling directly into magma chambers. But I know that John's excited about that. But
I've done it.
But let's be clear. For the most part, what you're talking about with geothermal is not in directly into magma. Correct, Anthony? It's getting close to that so that you're accessing the heat to create steam.
So at Augustine, we obviously have this shallow traditional hydrothermal system. And when I say shallow, you're looking at like, say, 2,000 feet below sea level. A lot of these geothermal wells are drilling in places like Nevada. Nevada's got by far the most geothermal production in the United States. So they're drilling 5,000 feet, 6,000, you know, very deep depths. The nice thing about Augustine is it's got the shallow magma chamber, and we've modeled it through the MT survey. So you look at even getting close to the magma chamber, you're looking at temperatures going from, say, 250 to 260 Celsius up to, say, 400 Celsius. So you're looking at orders of magnitude, and that's when you're looking at like gigawatt scale. That's when you're looking at things like data centers and e-fuels and things of that nature. So, and I want to correct myself. California is actually the number one producer of geothermal.
Right.
I apologize.
But you're getting close to the magma, not going into the magma, although John wants to.
Oh,
so
yes.
Here's the question. This person writes in, I have a question for Dr. John Eichelberger. Drilling into a magma chamber sounds inherently dangerous. How do we know it won't trigger a volcanic eruption?
It's been done many times, actually, in Hawaii, in Iceland, and in the East African Rift at Kenya. The worst problem anybody ever had was getting their bit stuck, which is an expensive problem. But the thing is that water just quenches it, turns it to glass, and you end up with an obsidian plug at the bottom of the hole. So it's controlled by normal geothermal methods. So we don't know, and we need a big, and I mean big, public, private, volcanology, geothermal engineer projects. I've started one in Iceland. The money is still waiting. I hope Anthony and I can start one here in Augustine. That is what it needs, is some experimentation of how best you get the heat out of this incredible untapped resource. It might be getting close. It might be putting a heat exchanger in. Actually, this stuff was tried 50 years ago at Sandia Labs and judged to be feasible.
Gwen, we only have a few minutes left here. I wanted to get back to you. Talk about what you call the cascading uses of geothermal that are happening in Iceland right now. And this is a great opportunity to plug your podcast, Closing the Gap with Gwen Holdman.
That's right. I think Iceland is definitely a place. And, you know, John and I have both spent a lot of time, you know, working in Iceland. They're doing some really forward thinking things. But one of the things that they're doing is they're looking at ways that they can use geothermal across like a whole spectrum of different use cases. And so I mentioned earlier around, you know, food production. Iceland actually produces about 50% of the food that's grown on island, or that's eaten on island, that's consumed on island, they grow it on island. And a lot of that's due to like geothermally heated greenhouses. The entire island is essentially heated, almost every residence and business, with geothermal energy. And at these power plants, they often have like clusters where they have additional industrial, you know, activities going on that also take advantage of this geothermal fluid after it's coming out of the power plant, for everything from algae production to like carbon capture sequestration approaches. And then my favorite one is the Blue Lagoon, which many people have heard of, which is, you know, this amazing sort of tourist facility there. And that's really just industrial effluent from one of their geothermal power plants. So they've got all these different ways that they're beneficially using geothermal energy there. And so one of the things I've done, I was actually a Fulbright scholar working over in Iceland on geothermal, and spent a lot of time there recording these podcast episodes about what Iceland is doing and how they've gone through the process across time of developing these geothermal resources and developing the techniques and the approaches for bringing that all to fruition. So it's Closing the Gap with Gwen Holman. You can find it pretty much anywhere.
And we will link to it on the Talk of Alaska post on our website at alaskapublic.org. Please clarify when you say effluent. That sounds awful, but so in this case, it's not, correct?
Well,
it's not a negative effluent.
Well, we think often as effluent as like a waste product, right, as like a bad thing, but this is geothermal fluid that's gone through this power generation cycle where there's still, you know, heat energy available. And instead of pumping it back underground in this particular case, they're putting it into this lagoon, right? So it's gone through that power generation cycle. It's had some heat extracted from it there. Mm. There's still heat left. There's also a lot of minerals associated with it. And that's part of like what the attraction is to that particular site. And so they've managed to take this, like what otherwise would be a waste product, and make it into this like multi tens of millions of dollars tourist attraction, which I think is pretty brilliant. Icelanders are very creative when it comes to using their geothermal resources.
All right. In our final minute here, Anthony, I want to turn back to you. If development continues to track with your current studies, you said as an example, if you have numerous wells at Augustine, it could produce potentially hundreds of megawatts of power. But there's also other uses. We talked a little bit about some of those. You said that one of the great things about geothermal is that it's base load power. What does that mean, and why is that important?
So basically, the runtime on a typical geothermal plant is about 96% runtime, which is similar to like a natural gas-fired power plant. So both from a reliability standpoint into the grid, but more importantly from a reliability standpoint from an industrial perspective. So say, for example, if you're feeding electricity into a data center or into something that's making hydrogen, it's really hard to use non-baseload power because you can't turn that process of making the products on and off. So when you have a continuous flow of electricity going into these processes, it's just much more efficient. So one thing that we're really attractive to is obviously, you know, we talked about data centers. Sustainable aviation fuel is another huge one. Mm-hmm. The airport here uses 2 million gallons of aviation fuel a day. And almost all that comes from Asia. So it's all imported from out of the country. SAF, there's a big push for sustainable aviation fuel that has, you know, obviously zero carbon in it. And so there's marketplaces within Alaska that I think that we can go to. And there's a lot of opportunity there.
Wow, this hour went by way too fast. Thanks so much to my guest, John Eichelberger, who is the geothermal program manager for the DNR. Anthony Panino, who is on the board of directors for GeoAlaska, and Gwen Holdman, who is the chief scientist and program lead for the UAF Center for Energy and Power. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phones, I think Ava White. Ava White helped us out today. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.